The following is a recording of General Wesley Clark presenting Deglobalization, Threats and Opportunities on October 4th, 2019. The opening welcome is by World Affairs Council of Hilton Head new president, John Gilbert.
I want to welcome you all. I know it's a big crowd today, but we've got screens around. You ought to be able to see and hear most of what you need to. I do want to say one thing. I am still not David Eisenhower. But I'm here in another capacity. And one of the first things I want to do today is thank Lee Wilwerding for his years as president and being up here on the stage. And Ruth, who helped him a lot more than she'll acknowledge. We also have a couple of other guests here today. Frank Rodriguez, the new superintendent of Beaufort County Schools, is here. And many of you know and have contributed to two programs that we sponsor for high school students here in Beaufort County. One is called Academic World Quest, which is a competition whose winner ends up going to Washington, D.C. to compete nationally. And another program called Model UN, where people compete locally as well as regionally. Both those involve the schools. Two schools have representatives here today. Up in the balcony here is May River. And I actually recognize a couple of people up there. And Hilton Head Prep also has representatives. And we hope to see more of them. On kind of a negative note, Congressman Joe Cunningham had also planned to be here today. However, last evening, his son was hospitalized. Joe spent the night in the hospital, and I understand he's still there. So he sends his regrets and hopes he has another opportunity to attend something down here. Having said that, one more announcement before we begin. This is a copy of Local Life, one of our local magazines published here on the island. I believe page 42 is the start of an interview with today's speaker, General Clark. So if you happen to see a copy of that, be sure to read it. It's got a lot of interesting information in it about his background and his views on life. So having said that, let's go ahead and begin. I want to introduce Ben Kinnis, our program committee chairman, who will give a brief introduction to our speaker.
Thank you all for being here, and we appreciate this very large crowd for our guests today. It's my privilege to introduce to you our 2019-2020 keynote speaker. In writing this introduction, I searched far and wide for accolades that have not yet been given. They are not to be found. Wesley Clark rose to the rank of four-star general during a 38-year career of military service. He graduated first in his class from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and was selected as a Rhodes Scholar to study at Oxford University, where he earned an MA in economics. As a young officer in Vietnam, General Clark commanded an infantry company and suffered severe wounds in combat. He later commanded at the battalion, brigade, and division levels, including the famed 1st Cavalry Division. He was also director for strategic plans and policy on the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington, working with U.S. diplomat Richard Holbrooke to negotiate an end to the conflict in Bosnia. General Clark's military career culminated as NATO's Supreme Allied Commander Europe, during which he led combined military forces to victory in Operation Allied Force, protecting and saving 1.5 million Kosovo Albanians from ethnic cleansing. His awards include the Presidential Medal of Freedom, Defense Distinguished Service Medal, U.S. Army Distinguished Service Medal, the Silver Star, Bronze Star, and the Purple Heart. Since retiring from the Army, General Clark has authored four books, including A Time to Lead, Winning Modern Wars, Waging Modern War, and Don't Wait for the Next War. That's his book. He ran for U.S. President in the 2004 Democratic primary. Today, General Clark serves as chairman and CEO of Wesley K. Clark & Associates, a strategic consulting firm. Chairman and founder of Invera, a licensed investment bank, chairman of Energy Security Partners, as well as numerous corporate boards. He is active in energy, including biofuels, electric power, and batteries, as well as finance and security. He is a highly sought-after commentator on national news networks, and the general has received numerous honorary doctorates and other civilian honors. In the nonprofit space, General Clark is senior fellow at UCLA's Burkle Center for International Relations, a director of the Atlantic Council, and founding chair of City of the Year Little Rock in North Little Rock. General Clark's most recent undertaking is a nonprofit called Renew America Together. Renew America Together is designed to promote and achieve greater common ground in America by reducing partisan division and gridlock. The mission is to revitalize public and political discourse by teaching and promoting civics, citizenship, and civility. And so with that, General Clark, welcome to the World Affairs Conference at Hilton Head.
Thank you, Ben. Ben, thanks very much for that kind introduction, and thank you all for being here today. It's a real thrill for me to be here in Hilton Head. I've been here many times, and it's great to be here and see old friends. If I start naming them, I'm going to get myself in trouble, but retired General Fig Newton's here, and retired General Art Brown, West Point classmates, Connie Budge, who was married to my West Point roommate who was killed in Vietnam, and her husband, Larry Budge, who's a Rhodes Scholar from the class of 61 and a retired general officer. Just so many wonderful people here, and this is a great group because you have the ability to actually move U.S. policy. I don't for a minute think that this is a retired audience. I know you're engaged with friends and colleagues and former colleagues all over the country and all over the world, and so what you say matters. So as Ben said, I've started a not-for-profit called Renew America Together because the public dialogue is so toxic and America is so divided, and it's divided because it's really in the interest of the media and political parties and other groups to force the distinction between the two parties. But if you actually go across and talk to Americans, they mostly agree on most everything. Sometimes there's a difference in priorities, difference in intensities of feelings on certain issues, but there's a real broad spectrum of agreement. So I've lined up a bunch of distinguished former Republican officers, office holders like Trent Lott and Mike Huckabee, Tom Ridge, and others to go out with me. We're going to go to college campuses and world affairs clubs and so forth when it fits their schedule, strictly on a volunteer basis, and talk about the issues that face America, not asking for money and not asking for votes. And so I think it'll be effective as long as we can find time in these busy men's and women's schedules to actually make the commitment to do it. But that's not really why I'm here today. What I really want to talk about today is your theme on globalism and what it means. And as Ben said, I've been really lucky in my life. I've had the chance to be at the top of three professions: the military, business, where I've worked with Goldman Sachs and Blackstone. I have my own investment bank, and of course, I got to run for president, so I saw politics from the inside at the highest level. I ran as a Democrat, so for those of you that supported me, thank you. For those of you that didn't, please don't hold it against me that I ran as a Democrat. I just saw what was coming in Iraq. I knew what was going to happen. I knew the Army. I knew the intelligence, and I had a really bad feeling about it. So I'd never been in partisan politics. I didn't even run for student council. So it was a major departure in my life, but in 5 months, I made it to 30 states. We raised $23 million. I won the Oklahoma primary. And most importantly, I learned about America and how different and how diverse it is. And I heard the stories of Americans, and I got tutored by some of the smartest people in healthcare and economics and business and finance. And so it really opened up my horizons. It was a great experience. But, you know, I'm still an Army guy at heart, and I probably had the best assignment you could ever have in the armed forces. I was a Supreme Allied Commander Europe. I had responsibility for 89 nations in the U.S. European Command. I had responsibility for NATO's, at that time, 19 members and 24 members of Partnership for Peace. I had 8 four-star generals who worked for me. And the reason I give you a title like that, Supreme, is because you need it when you're working with 8 other four-star generals. I had a personal staff of 100, 2 UH-60 helicopters, a DC-9, 2 Gulfstreams, 2 armored limousines, security detail of 30 people, lived in a chateau, had head of state status, got the blue light special treatment, traveling around Europe, could talk to heads of state, and then I retired. Go to Fort Myer, beautiful sunny day in June. The old guard's on parade. They put your last medal on. You make some remarks. Everybody's there, a bunch of classmates, people from my hometown of Little Rock, Arkansas. And then you stand in line with your wife, and they shake your hand, and it goes on for maybe 30 or 40 minutes. And then you look around, and there's nobody there. Your aide, he's gone. The security detail that guarded you with their lives, their backs are turned. They're moving back to the Pentagon. And they had parked my car, and without any help, I found my own way to my own car that I hadn't driven in 4 years. I opened the door, I got in, and my wife said, "Honey, what are you doing sitting in the back seat?" So when I was a major, I got to work for General Alexander Haig when he was Supreme Allied Commander. And he always said that when you give a speech, it has to follow 3 rules. You have to have a snappy beginning, a snappy ending, and keep the 2 as close together as possible. So I'm going to try to do that today. I'm going to sketch through some things, and then I really want to hear what you think about things. Look, today is Friday, the 4th of October. So in Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, the executive, has said that the protesters can't wear masks. Today is Friday, the 4th of October, the 4th week for the General Motors strike by United Auto Workers. No sign that it's ending. General Motors has lost $1 billion so far. Wall Street says, keep it up. Today is Friday, the 4th of October, and Washington is digesting the latest news in the impeachment inquiry. What do these 3 events have in common? That's what I want to talk about. So I'm going to give you 5 propositions. I'm going to kind of sketch them out and then conclude as rapidly as I can and then take your questions. So proposition number 1, the American century is over. America's greatest generation, we still got some. I was at the 75th anniversary at Normandy. And I got to shake hands with men who'd actually been there on D-Day. But that generation is passing fast. And the American century, well, we're still great, but we've lost our super extraordinary position in the world. It's the rise of other powers. Inevitable. We tried to end poverty, and we were pretty successful. Countries like India, going to be a great power in the 21st century. China is already there. We've been overextended militarily. And I love the men and women in our armed forces, and they did wonderful at what they were trying to do in Iraq and Afghanistan. But we didn't win. And we have to live with that. We did spend a lot of money, 5,000 dead, 25,000 wounded, about 2,000 permanently crippled. We distorted our defense budget for 20 years while everybody else caught up. We got national debt. trillion dollars extra this year. We've got investment problems. My Chinese friends come to the United States and they say, "Oh, General Clark, we give you $40 million to fix railroad between Washington and New York." Well, you know what? You can't fix a railroad between Washington and New York, even if they gave me $40 billion. It's too hard. Our infrastructure is obsolescent. We haven't invested in it. And of course, we've got this political turmoil that's deepened and gotten more divisive. Along with this, of course, your theme, globalization, I think we're seeing the end of globalization as it was known during the 1990s. The bright hope that somehow everybody could open their markets to free trade, that there would be an unlimited expansion of human wants and employment would keep pace, that workers from displaced industries would find new employment and be even happier because they were dealing with everyday low prices. I think what we're seeing is that the Washington consensus that I was proud to represent across Latin America when I was commander of U.S. Southern Command in 1996-97, the idea of neoliberal economy, the idea that get government out of the way, deregulate, put the emphasis on the private sector, let the market find a solution, that's not any longer the prevailing consensus, or parts of it are fading at least. Proposition one, the American century is over. Proposition two, we've got long-term problems facing the United States that our political system simply is not capable or hasn't shown itself capable of dealing with. We've got the problem of terrorism. Now, we've whacked people all over the world, and we've deployed forces, and we've got an Army and Navy Special Operations Forces in 80 countries, and we've created what General Colin Powell calls the security industrial complex. But they're still out there, and they're still after us. Young men and young women who feel insignificant, who are searching for meaning in their lives, and so desperate for it, they'll kill themselves and others along with them to seek for meaning. We haven't really dealt with this problem. All it takes is one bomb on an aircraft that brings it down over the Atlantic or the Persian Gulf or some other place, and we'll be back in the throes of panic and fear again. Cyber. We created the internet. I remember when I was looking at, in 1988, when we first started the Army training system with on the internet, I went to see some people with General Paul Gorman, and there were these scientists typing on a computer, and they're like, "Oh, this is, it's going to $XX.. I said, "What is this?" He said, "Oh, this is the ARPANET or the DARPANET or the internet." And I'm like, "Well, why do you need that? Why don't you just call them on the phone?" And we created it, and now we're the most dependent on it in the whole world. And we're the most vulnerable. So we've started to realize how serious this is. You know, Russia shut down half of Ukraine's electric power with a cyber attack in 2015. In 2007, Russia shut down the complete system of government in Estonia. So NATO has a cyber thing, but our problem in the United States is that it's not enough to have a cyber command that protects the government. It's about the whole economy. All it takes is an EMP weapon or some kind of cyber strike against the electric power grid, and we're out of business. And if it's a large EMP strike that destroys transformers, we might be out of business permanently because there's no backup for these big transformers. Now, the utility industry doesn't want to quite say this publicly because it would create a panic. But the truth is that no one's more vulnerable to cyber than we are, and yet we're the ones who started it, and we're using it as a reconnaissance tool and even occasionally as a weapon, even as we complain about other people doing the same thing. We haven't come to terms with that. And there's the financial system and the economy. Look, debt is like sugar. And those of you who've been in the banking system and in private sector know that if you can get really low interest debt, You can do a lot with it, provided you're very confident in your Excel spreadsheet and you know that you've got the revenues to cover the debt payments and can eventually get out of it. And maybe you don't even need that. Maybe you just need, you know, 3 or 4 years and you can sell the business and let somebody else worry about it. But right now, debt's higher than it was in 2008. And, you know, we put in the reforms of the Dodd-Frank before we actually had done the lessons learned on the financial crisis. And now those reforms on Dodd-Frank are being disassembled. Truth is, banking is a big industry in America. It's the financialization of the economy is the greatest thing that's happened to America in the last 30 years. In the 1960s and 70s, financial firms' profits were about 10% of corporate profits. Now they're about 40% of corporate profits. So every young man my age who wanted to be anybody wanted to study physics, work atomic energy, or help get to outer space. Young men and women today want to go in to Wall Street. They like finance because they know that if you go in and understand finance, you have control of and access to resources, and you can do amazing things very quickly. So we financialized the economy. But with it, what we've done is we've also created the greatest disparity of wealth and income since the Great Depression of the 1920s. And that's becoming a significant issue. Then there's managing the rise of China. Now, I know many of you have been to China many times. I started in 1983. I remember being briefed on the four modernizations of China: agriculture, industry, technology, and then finally the military. But Deng Xiaoping said that China should, his advice was like, hide your light under a bushel basket. In other words, don't let people see the real direction you're heading in. So I had my worries in the 1990s when we declared that China should become a member of the World Trade Organization, that China would inevitably have to become democratic because you can't grow without the free flow of information. Everybody knew that, and so how could you have that if you weren't democratic? So it sort of was a logical syllogism, but it underestimated the power, the durability, the ferocity, the smarts of the Chinese Communist Party. So that hasn't happened. And today we have a country that's 4 times the population, equal in purchasing power parity, has a China dream, and wants what we have, which is world leadership. And honestly, they deserve it. I mean, historically, the center of human civilization has always been China. All the great inventions started in China. And whether it was the compass, fireworks, kites, you name it, it all started in China. The Romans knew about China. They wanted silk, but the Chinese wanted nothing from Rome but gold. The only thing the barbarians had that China didn't have was enough gold. And so for 3,000 years, China was the center. And then in the 19th century, it fell apart. And the Europeans came in, they gave opium, they set up their own government systems inside China, they abused the emperor, China descended into chaos, there was half a century of civil war, there was an invasion by Japan, and then Mao Zedong took over. Millions died, but China today has been transformed. And the world has never seen such a large country change so dramatically. And their ambitions are not limited. And then there's climate change. You're at Hilton Head, and you're, I don't know, I hope you're more than 20 feet above sea level. Flood insurance is going up. You know, flood insurance is subsidized. I asked one congresswoman, said, what's the most important thing you've worked on this week? She said, flood insurance. It's a big argument every year. And so all of our coastal communities are in danger. About the only place that hadn't been affected by climate change is my state of Arkansas. We like it. It's nice and warm there, got plenty of rainfall, nothing much has changed, and if you talk to people there, they say, climate change, that's just like weather. But that's not what most of the world thinks, and that's not what the scientific evidence shows. And yet, we're on a carbon budget. The world is putting 45 billion tons a year of carbon into the atmosphere. And when you reach a certain level, and the permafrost and the Arctic thaws, and the deep ocean warms, and we're belching methane up into the atmosphere, climate change could become runaway. So the Greenland ice cap can raise sea levels maybe 20 feet, but it won't melt alone. You've got the Antarctic ice cap that could raise sea levels maybe 60 feet. And so we don't know what the future holds. We don't know how fast this is going to work. All we know is that every time the scientists do a model, 5 years later, it's proved wrong. So we're not doing much about climate change. We haven't really figured out China. Got record levels of debt and income inequality. We're still vulnerable to cyber in the private sector. And there's still terrorists out there who want to kill us. So we've got big problems that we haven't faced. These problems are, they all have something in common. You have to work internationally for solutions. They take money. There's no single fix. Industry and government have to work together. And you can't solve it during the incumbency of a single president. These are long-term problems. And our system, thus far, is not doing a very good job on that. See, here's my third proposition. They always tell you, you know, this is the most important election in your lifetime. When I ran for office, that's what they taught me to say. Oh, you got it. This is it. I mean, this is about the Iraq War, okay? Sounded important. The truth is, the American political system moves in 30 and 40-year cycles. So we've had three cycles since the American Civil War. The first was the Gilded Age. It was rampant capitalism. No market supervision, no controls. It ended up with the robber barons, the trusts, the Carnegies, the Vanderbilts, the steel magnates, and so forth, and huge inequalities and a raging sense of injustice in the country. And that gave way to the second cycle. Not overnight, but over a period of two decades, we moved into the progressive era. Theodore Roosevelt, direct election of senators, the income tax amendment to the U.S. Constitution, women's suffrage, and finally, with Franklin D. Roosevelt, regulation of markets, the Securities and Exchange Commission formed, more powers to the Federal Reserve System, and Social Security. And finally, even to Lyndon Johnson with Medicare. Richard Nixon kept it going. He formed the EPA. It was the administrative state. There was a sense of the common good, a sense that people needed to be together. Marginal tax rates, when I was a little kid, were 91%. So Kennedy was a big hero in 1962 when he cut the top rate to 70%, and the economy boomed. And so people thought, boy, look at this. But, you know, we had the Fairness in Media Act, Huntley Brinkley, Walter Cronkite. People watched the three network news stations. And it was a different era in America. And that gave way to the age of Reagan. So there was a new economics. Keynes was out. Milton Friedman was in. George H. Bush called it voodoo economics, but that was before he became Reagan's running mate. And it was supply-side economics. Get government out of the way. Stop encroaching on the private sector. Let the private sector pick winners. Deregulate. You can't determine what's fair or not in media, so get rid of the law so people can make money in the media. Fox News, MSNBC, Rush Limbaugh. I remember when I came back from Europe and I gave a speech down in Palm Beach, at the Four Arts Society. We went to the lunch before that at the Everglades Club, and a woman said to my wife as we were walking in, she says, of course, we'd been living in Belgium for 4 years, 3 years, and she said, "Don't you just love Rush Limbaugh?" And my wife said, "Huh?" Because we weren't tuned in. We were still, you know, thinking about the networks. We didn't understand what was changing in America. So we're now 40 years into the age of Reagan. And we've moved through, in the age of Reagan, union busting, lower taxes, deregulation, value voting came in. You know, in the Federalist Papers, they said that Madison and Hamilton wrote Federalist 51, the great problem of factions. So let ambition counteract ambition, counteract interest. But they didn't say anything about values. And so once the moral majority came in the 1980s and America became laden with value voting, it became much more difficult to work the compromises that made the American system work. Of course, what happened also in the age of Reagan was the offshoring, the financialization of the economy, growing disparities of wealth and income, deepening conflicts between Congress and the executive, and the continuing growth of executive power. Some people think that President Trump is just like he came in from outer space, but actually, he's just continuing the trends, and he's reflecting a new trend because he's reflecting the end of the Washington consensus of globalization, of the idea that America has a wonderful marketplace, it should be open to everybody, and it's good for the consumers. Donald Trump got elected by looking at people who didn't have jobs because of globalization and playing to their concerns and their grievances and their fears. And we know that. And so that's the beginning of the end of the age of Reagan. Now, this might flip in 2020, 2024, 2028. It's too soon to know. But what you're going to see is, it's like we always said in the Army, anything worth doing is worth overdoing. So America goes in these big, huge cycles. So maybe we overdid the age of Reagan. I mean, private markets are great. Capitalism's wonderful. Can't change human nature. You've got the profit motive. It's great. But maybe it's going too far. Maybe it needs to come back. And I'm sure when it starts to come back, we'll probably overdo it in the other direction. Higher taxes, more focus on the common good, more government leadership, programs like the interstate highway system that Ike put in, increased regulation, emphasis on fairness, greater focus on education and health care, and the people who are left out. So we don't know when that's going to flip, but that'll be the fourth cycle if we make it that far. Because you see, here's my fourth proposition. We're actually in an existential crisis for democracy right now. You know, Abraham Lincoln, in the Gettysburg Address, this famous conclusion of that government for the people, of the people, by the people will not fail, will not disappear from the face of the earth. And yet, that's the struggle that we're in. We're in that struggle with China. It's an alternate model, two fundamentally different systems. They want what we have, friends, allies, wealth, leadership, but they've got a single party mandarinate system, the best and the brightest. And it's no different. It is different, but it's very similar to the U.S. Armed Forces. You start them out in the Communist Party at a village level. You see if they can do the job as a second lieutenant. And there's a branch manager who looks at them based on their education. And then they go through a progressive series of assignments and schooling and broadening. They have to prove their loyalty. They have to prove their competence. And eventually they make it up a few to the leadership level. It's a good, strong system. We know it because that's what those of us who came through the military lived with. And that's where China is governed. To China, Western democratic values are their greatest enemy. These young Chinese students that come to the United States, go to our universities, they love it here. There's nobody looking over their shoulder. They're away from their parents. They're away from the school teachers and university leadership in China. They're free. They're free. And they look at this around them and they say, why can't China be like this? Democratic values are like a virus infection. Once you catch it, it spreads. And so, to the Communist Party of China, Western democratic values pose the deepest, greatest threat. You can see this in the tightening grip of the Chinese Communist Party on Hong Kong. Probably not going to end well. You're going to look back on it a year or two from now and say, I wonder what happened to those young people. Because in my generation, we had Tiananmen Square when China was opening up and English was being taught and the files of the Communist Party were opened. But they went to Xi Jinping and said, what do you think? And Xi Jinping said, crush them. Thousands of people were killed in 1989 across China. The United States stopped military relations. We put them under pressure, but it only lasted a few years. Nothing changed in China, but we changed, and we brought them in. So you're going to see most likely a replay with Hong Kong. You see, what we have in our system is an institutionalized open conflict in a federal system. We separate powers. We designed checks and balances in. And to China, nothing could be more frightening than something like this because they know the consequences. In China, every 40 years or so, there's a catastrophe, and millions of people die, and people lose their wealth and their homes and so forth. That's why my Chinese friends are struggling to get their money out of China. They may be proud to be Chinese and proud of what China's accomplished, but they don't trust it. They trust us because they believe in America there's a government of laws, not of men. But if you look around the world, and you talk to foreign leaders, look, it looks like China has the winning model for the 21st century. It's based on sustained record of growth and development. They have industrial policy. They actually can decide they're going to move industries from the seacoast on the east westward into China, and the industries actually move. Now, some of these are state-owned enterprises, so it's a kind of Potemkin capitalism. It's not real. That is to say, it's not really market forces, because in every business in China, every significant business, there's a Communist Party team leader who reports, and he has the ultimate say in what the business does and who gets hired and fired, and he can intervene if he wants. So they use the market system for pricing to some extent, but every year when I go to the Milken Conference, somebody says, China's economy, it's going to collapse because of all those non-performing loans. It's like, are you crazy? All they have to do is say, those loans don't count. They write them off. They've got whole villages that are built out there standing empty. And China hasn't collapsed because it's an entirely different model. And around the world, leaders look at this and they say, what's the right model for my country? Do I want it to be like America? I mean, like America, great shopping. But China, look at what they're doing, the progress. So we are, we're in a contest. Now look, there's no doubt about it. They stole our technology. They took our money. They used our educational system. They're still hacking us. It's a different system. Can we compete without modifying our system? I mean, we do have industrial policy, even though if you talk to American economists, they'll say, oh, industrial policy, no, it's no good. The French tried it. They formed a French national perfume company with Brigitte Bardot, and it failed. Nobody liked the perfume. Industrial policy, it doesn't work. But actually, we have our industrial policy. It's in healthcare, and it's in defense. And that's why we have the best set of technologies in the world, the greatest armed forces, and the greatest outpouring of medical devices, technology, and pharmaceuticals. That's our industrial policy. Unfortunately, it's not broad enough to to take us forward into the 21st century. But look, we can't handle China without allies. China's in Germany, France, Britain, the EU, Latin America, the British. They want China to run their nuclear power system. I was just dealing with East Europeans last week in New York, and the former Prime Minister of Georgia said, "Oh, I know you're worried about China, but their investments are very helpful to us." I know. And they've got a One Belt, One Road system. They're investing all over the world. Those investments don't come with human rights concerns. They don't go in and say, "You better release those dissidents or you're not going to get our loan." No, they come with massive corruption and buying people in these countries and eventually with strings attached. China's strategy is absolutely transparent. You can see it. I've seen it coming for years. But it's just now that we're finally focused on this because they have hypersonic glide vehicles. We don't have them in our defense sector. They've taken over the South China Sea. We let them do it. They're pushing really hard on Japan. We did stand up on that, so they'll find another way. As they told me in 2013 when I was in the Philippines, I was in China, and the Chinese government said, "You Americans, you have alliance with Singapore. What is Singapore? A tiny island." They said, "And you think the Philippines is your friend? We give $100 billion in remittances to Philippines each year. If we tell Philippines no American bases, there will be no American bases." So China recognizes its power. We've got to have allies. The conflict with China could become military. They want us out of the Western Pacific. They want us out of Korea, Taiwan, Guam, Okinawa, the South China Sea. We're going to have to rethink aircraft carriers, invest in lasers, drones, hypersonics, the role of the Army out there, artificial intelligence, going to be a big investment area. But look, President Trump doesn't want war. Nobody sensible wants war with China. If China loses, we lose, because they're a key part of the world economy and we're dependent on it. And if China wins, then how do we win with it? That's the question. But war could happen. And at home, what we have is impeachment or permanent reshaping of the American government that's distracting us from everything else going on. Now, I don't want you to think that I'm giving you a gloomy picture. This is the challenge for America. And as Americans, don't we rise up to challenges? Don't we love a good challenge? That's how we made this country. This is our opportunity. This is given to us by our Creator. We brought ourselves, with His help or her help, to this position. You see, we're now a land of plenty. It took humankind maybe 150,000 years, 100,000 years, and stabilization of the climate after the last ice age ended 10 or 12,000 years ago to really develop agriculture. And agriculture developed for thousands of years. We've only been in the industrial age 300 years. And now we're in the information age. We're looking at artificial intelligence. We're looking at cyborgs. We're looking at unlimited productive capacity if we want it. The problem we have in industry is we could make all this stuff, but who's going to buy it? Our closets are filled with clothes. You don't need all those clothes, seriously. Not even all the shoes and all the golf stuff that we buy. I mean, don't really need it. It's there. I mean, it's nice to have it. But we're awash in plenty. Malthus was wrong. We are not going to end up overpopulating and starving ourselves. There's 1 billion acres of unused cropland in the world. Productivity in the Corn Belt goes up 3% on average every year. I've done a lot of work with our farmers in Iowa and South Dakota. I know how smart they are and how good they are. We can produce all the food the world ever needs on this planet. And we have all the technology to take care of the planet. We can develop the technology to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. We don't have to deal with climate change. We can develop electric propulsion. We can get all the energy we need from renewable energy. We can have clean nuclear power if we want it. We can do anything we want. We're at this incredible moment of opportunity in a land of plenty. We have to, for the first time, we can free up human potential. We can establish a new ethic. You know, now I'm a banker, okay, so I say this, but not tongue-in-cheek, but capitalism is an exploitative process. It's competition. From the time we were hunter-gatherers as a species and competed to see who was going to get the mastodon and the best parts of the mastodon to eat, we've been competitive because there was an assumed scarcity. There's no such scarcity if we really look at what the world is, our technology, and what could be provided. There's no reason for anybody to go to bed hungry or cold or not have electric power or not have an education. All of that we can do. We need to establish a new ethic, a non-exploitative society. Look at this, what's going on in Detroit with this workers' strike. Here they are. They would like higher wages. The goal of the automobile companies, backed by the bankers, is take the loss, play the long term, and cut their wages. I was at the Caterpillar factory in 2012. I went through it looking at renewable energy opportunities. And, of course, I'm an old armor officer, so I know all about motor pools and repair sites. I mean, this was immaculate. And the troops in there were doing a great job and so forth. And that year, Caterpillar had record earnings. And so the union said, well, I mean, under the model, I mean, you know, you guys have got record earnings. All you execs got bonuses. Don't we get a little extra? I mean, after all, we're producing everything. And they said, actually, no, you don't. In fact, we want you to take a wage cut because next year might not be as good as this year. So please, can we reduce your wages by 10%? So they went on strike. The strike lasted for 6 weeks. They gave in because they ran out of money. They went back to work, and they took a 10% wage cut or something, and the Caterpillar execs got bonuses. Now, I know that's the model, and everybody in business school, you know, learns that model, and labor's the enemy, and it's about the Excel spreadsheet, but we could do better than that today. We could create an informed citizenry, freed from want. People just like yourselves, who have time and leisure, the education and the ability to focus on the important issues of society and how to make the society better for themselves and their children. We'd build it on education. We'd expect public service from everyone at some point in their lives. We'd have to have a new economic model reflecting social values, and you'd have to have a transition period, and it'd be a struggle because it's real tough to sort of reach into your pocketbook and say, yeah, I don't really need all this, it's a so forth. But this is where we are in America today. We have this opportunity. We can continue to sort of duke it out with China on the same model. We can continue to ignore the five big problems, or we can look at the incredible potential that we have at this moment in human history with this system of government, with the wealth that we have, the influence that we have in the world, and we can try to look over the horizon and see something better. We're going into the fourth cycle of American history. We're still the thought leaders of the world, despite the Chinese efforts. We can do this. It's up to you. You're the leaders, right here in the World Affairs Council at Hilton Head. Thank you.